Okay, in our second panel this morning, we're going to move from the overview of the pluses and minuses, complications, if you will, of public-private partnerships in transportation infrastructure, and we're going to get down to cases, and these are really reports from the front lines, people who are involved from the public sector side, from the private sector side, people who are really on the firing line of these situations, Chicago, Pennsylvania, and right here in New York, two leasing projects and one potential greenfield project, I guess. If you build a parallel span of the Tappan Zee, I guess that's a green bridge or something like that. And then we're going to have a discussion from our last speaker of the politics of all of this. We're going to start with, I don't know if we want to call you the architect of the Chicago Skyway and Midway Airport deals, but you're certainly involved. John Schmidt is a partner in the Chicago international law firm of Mayer Brown. He's a nationally recognized attorney named by American Lawyers, one of the 27 all-stars of the 90s, okay, of the American Bar, and by the National Law Journal. And in recent years, he's been focused heavily on public-private partnerships, including the Chicago Skyway Toll Bridge. And he was named Deal Maker of the Year by the American Lawyer. So, with no further ado, John Schmidt.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here and talk about these subjects in such a distinguished gathering. They are very interesting subjects and very timely ones. I thought I would focus on two transactions that I think go together. They both involve the city of Chicago, and they are both pioneering transactions. The first is the Chicago Skyway transaction, in which, as was alluded to earlier, early 2005, the city of Chicago leased the Chicago Skyway to a consortium of Cintra Concesiones of Spain and Macquarie Infrastructure for $1.8 billion, the first privatization of an existing American toll road or toll bridge. The other transaction I want to talk about is one that was just announced this week, and that is the privatization of Midway Airport. As many of you may know, the city announced on Tuesday of this week that it had received a winning bid of $2,521,000,000 from a consortium that consists of the Vancouver Airport Authority, the Citigroup Infrastructure Fund, and John Hancock Insurance for a 99-year lease of Midway Airport, which will be the first privatization of a major American airport. That transaction has to be approved by the Chicago City Council, which is taking it up next Wednesday. And assuming it is approved, and I believe it will be, it will then be submitted for final approval by the Federal Aviation Administration, which is geared up and ready to go and eager to approve it before the end of the year. They have a 60-day mandatory statutory period before they can act, but I think if we can file the application by the end of next week, I think they expect to approve it before Christmas. So it will go forward as the first privatization of a major airport in this country. The other reason to talk about these together is that I think they really reflect basically the same fundamental thinking by the mayor and, you know, by those of us who have been his advisors in this area. And that is that out of these long-term leases, the city can get two essential things. The first is a higher quality of service for city residents and others who use these facilities. And the second is a lot more money for the city than it could get if it simply continued to operate the facilities itself. With respect to the quality of service, in the case of the Skyway, the effect of the lease was to shift operating control from the Chicago Department of Transportation, which I think is a competent public agency, to Cintra, which is the operating part of the Cintra Macquarie team, which is engaged in operating toll roads and toll bridges around the world, and I think brings to it the kind of skills and experience and the quality of personnel that a successful private business that focuses in a particular area brings to a project. And it is, I think, the virtually universal view in Chicago that the quality of Skyway operations has, in fact, improved. The first thing Cintra did was to put in place electronic tolling. Now, you can say city could have done that. City could have done it. The city had been talking about doing it, and had the transaction not been done, the city, I'm sure, would have gone on talking for a while, and at some point they would have done it. Cintra came in and did it. Another example that in some ways I think is more telling because it's less obvious is what happened when the good weather came. The transaction closed in January. In the spring, the traffic on the Skyway typically goes up on weekends because there is a heavy influx of Chicagoans who have weekend homes along the lakeshore. So there, for many years, have been backups on Friday night and Sunday evening. Cintra went to work, figured out a way to reconfigure the toll booths to put in an extra lane, and very quickly, the still some backups, but not nearly as bad. Could the city have done that? Yes, in theory, but it hadn't. In the case of the airport, since we haven't done the transaction yet, we obviously haven't seen the improvements in airport operations, but I really believe they're going to be more striking because airports are more complicated operations and there's a lot more room for managerial improvement. It's not because the city is not doing a good job of running Midway. I think it's a very well-run airport. You compare it to LaGuardia, it's a palace. But what is now going to happen is a major, really world-class operator, the Vancouver Airport Authority, is going to come in and take over the operations. And it was interesting, part of our deal with the airlines, in order to do this transaction, we have to have the approval of the airlines operating at Midway. And part of our deal was that we would not allow into the bidding anyone who the airlines did not think was qualified to operate the airport. So we had the prospective bidders come in and do presentations. It was very interesting to see the airline reaction, particularly Southwest, which has about 80% of the Midway traffic and therefore has a huge stake in the airport. Since they don't fly internationally, they had really had no exposure to private airport operations. It was interesting to see how strongly they responded to hearing the private airport operators talk about the customer experience, how they focus on trying to figure out what it is that airport customers really want, how to provide that in the most effective sort of way, make it a better experience. That's the way Southwest, if you know Southwest at all, really focuses on their customers in an almost obsessive way. And I think that seeing, hearing private airport operators talk in those terms really gave them a very high level of confidence and beyond that, enthusiasm for the idea of having an airport operator who would bring that same kind of energy and focus on the quality of the experience to Midway. Vancouver, which is the operating entity that's part of the winning team, is a spectacularly good airport operator. I think if you've ever been to Vancouver Airport, it often wins polls as the best airport in North America, has a wonderful array of amenities, has two spas, has a four-star hotel. I don't know if we'll get all of that at Midway, but I think there's a high level of enthusiasm for the notion that we're going to get a higher quality of operation. The other key element, of course, when you talk about an airport, the users are not just the passengers. The users are the airlines. And a critical element of this whole transaction is the agreement that we reached with the airlines as a condition of the deal that the winning concessionaire would take on a 25-year use agreement under which airline rates and charges are capped at a level that is actually slightly below the 2008 level and then frozen at that level for 6 years and then for the remainder of the term allowed to grow only by an annual increase equal to core CPI, CPI without food or energy. So that is a very good deal for the airlines. It is not only lower rates, but for Southwest, I think something particularly important is stability, predictability. They're an airline, as you know, which has done pretty well by worrying about risk. Well, one of the things that happens when you privatize an airport is the risks of airport operations, which currently are borne by the airlines under a residual cost structure, shift to a private operator. The trade-off is the private operator gets the benefits of what they can manage to make out of the airport, particularly on the non-airline side, but the airlines get the benefit of, in this case, really quite long-term stable rates and charges. So in terms of the quality of the airport, I think we're going to see a significant improvement for passengers. We are clearly going to see a significant improvement for the airlines in terms of stable, predictable, and lower rates and charges. having said all that, it's obvious the city doesn't just do this to benefit other people. The other key element for the city is the ability to get a lot more money out of these assets through a lease than it could get in any other way. And I think that that happens for essentially two reasons. One is when you shift the operating control of these assets to a private operator, the enterprise value goes up very substantially. More revenues and lower costs. On the revenue side, I think a lot of the factors were really alluded to earlier. A private operator is able to price its services in an economically rational way to maximize revenues in a way that public entities cannot. The issue on the Skyway is not really the presence or absence of political limits. You can put in place whatever limits you want. In the Pennsylvania Turnpike transaction that Roy will talk about, the limits under the proposed lease are at a level that is almost certainly below where the tolls will be if you simply keep the turnpike under public hands. But within whatever limits you establish, a private operator can make decisions to maximize revenues. No public entity can do that. The city of Chicago had not raised tolls on the Skyway for 13 years. That is true even though 75% of the drivers don't live in the city of Chicago, and the 25% who do live in the city represent a minuscule part of the city population. The Skyway is driven by a very small percentage of Chicagoans, probably less than 5%. But decisions by public entities like the City of Chicago, the Chicago City Council on tolls are not based upon a rational calculation of the greatest good of the greatest number. They are based upon a calculation of what kind of a reaction will there be from a group of people, however small, who will react negatively and therefore potentially take it out at when it comes to voting in terms of those public officials. The reality is that 5% drove decisions on toll setting for the Chicago Skyway. That phenomenon has been equally pronounced elsewhere. Indiana had not raised tolls on the Indiana Toll Road for 23 years. Same thing is evident if you look at airport pricing. Airport parking. Airport parking is underpriced virtually everywhere. And the reason is public entities have a visceral resistance to raise parking rates. On top of that, under the residual cost structure, they have no real incentive to raise parking rates. Because if you raise parking rates and raise parking revenues, say, at Midway, the only beneficiary at the moment are the airlines, who at the end of the year, under the residual cost structure, get lower rates and charges. So shifting the control of those kinds of operations to a private operator is clearly going to increase revenues. The other side of it is the cost side, and I would agree with what was said earlier about the ability of a private operator to reduce costs, particularly capital costs. At least in the case of the Skyway and now in the case of Midway, I don't think there are significant operating cost reductions. In the case of Midway, in order to get the support of the Chicago labor movement, which is actively supporting the transaction, we agreed to a set of provisions under which the private operator is going to have to offer jobs to anyone currently employed by the city at Midway on substantially equivalent terms. So there aren't going to be operating cost reductions, at least on the labor side. But when it comes to capital expenditures, it really came home to me when we were doing the Skyway deal. The city had done a large-scale reconstruction of the Skyway, but there was one viaduct that had not been completed. So under the terms of the deal, we mandated that the private operator take over and complete that construction project or carry it out. And one of the bidders asked at one point, do you have any estimates of what the cost of that viaduct are going to be? And the city transportation people said, well, we do, but don't give it to them because they're going to be able to do it for half as much. And in fact, the rough estimate, I think, is 25 to 50%. Is a good estimate of what a private operator can do. When we were talking to the airlines about the Midway transaction, one of the things that I think was most persuasive to them on why it would make sense was when we talked about the fact that a private operator would be able to carry out capital expenditures at a substantially reduced rate. They all immediately said that's right. It turns out they fight with airport public authorities around the country to get control of capital projects, because they know they can do them more cheaply. The extreme of that is they try to get control enough to build their own terminals. So they were immediately responsive and accepted the fact that a private operator would be able to carry out projects, capital costs that are substantially reduced. So you put those two things together, higher revenues and lower costs, you have an enterprise that produces more value, and that value can be reflected in the terms of the lease. The one other point, I would stop with this one. Even if that were not true, even if there were no increase in the enterprise value, a lease transaction of this kind is the only way that I can see, and I think the mayor and others could see, for the city to recover its equity value in these assets and redeploy that value for other purposes. We don't need public capital in the Skyway. We did at one time in order to build it. And the city made that decision, sustained the Skyway over a long period of years. Ultimately, it took off, became sufficiently viable, that there clearly, by the time we did the deal in 2004, is a substantial equity that the city has in that asset. Same thing is true today in Midway Airport. The city has the capacity, through a leasing transaction, to recover that equity, and if it wants to, redeploy it and use it for another purpose. The fact that you can recover some capital doesn't necessarily mean you should. Ultimately, the question, I think, is do you have some other use, some better use of that capital? In the case of the Skyway, the city took the $1.8 billion of proceeds, paid off about $450 million of debt, and used almost all the remainder to shore up the city's finances by establishing a $500 million reserve, paying off city debt, doing some other things, and the end result was an increase in the city's bond rating and a long-term, large-scale saving for the city in carrying out capital projects. I'm not at all sure that the city could have made the guarantees that are necessary for purposes of the Olympics bid in 2016 had it not done the Skyway transaction and therefore shored up its finances. In the case of Midway, 90% of the proceeds is to be used for infrastructure within the city. So that's money into city infrastructure at a time when other sources are minimal, to put it mildly. Those choices, the choices to recover that capital, use it for those other purposes, I think seems to the mayor, seem to me to be really no-brainers. It seems to me was similarly easy for Governor Daniels to make the decision to put the $3.8 billion of capital he could recover from the Indiana Toll Road into other transportation infrastructure in Indiana. I think it's pretty easy to make the same judgment in Pennsylvania, but the Pennsylvania General Assembly hasn't yet been able to reach that conclusion. Let me just give you two numbers in conclusion. If you value the existing toll roads and toll bridges in this country at a Skyway or Indiana or Pennsylvania number, you easily get to $250 billion or more. Midway represents 1% of U.S. airport passenger traffic. So if you value airports on a per passenger basis the same way as Midway, the U.S. airports are worth $250 billion. In fact, they're worth more because there are a lot of airports that have growth potential beyond Midway. So there is easily a $500 billion of asset value there that could be recovered, redeployed to meet other infrastructure needs. To me, it's an absolute no-brainer that cities and states in this country and the nation as a whole would benefit from doing exactly that. Let me stop with that. Thank you.
Janet, I just got to ask you really quickly, to what do you attribute the fact that these have gone forward in Chicago? Why has it been possible to complete these deals, which are so unusual?
Well, the comment about strong leadership is certainly right. I have said that if you want to decide who is going to move forward with the transactions of this kind, it's not a partisan judgment. Rich Daley is a Democrat. Mitch Daniels is a Republican. Ed Rendell is a Democrat. But give a Rorschach test and look at the temperament of those three people, all three people who are not afraid of a fight, clearly, you know, confident enough to put themselves forward for something that they believe in. In Rich Daley's case, of course, he's been mayor for a very long time, so he looks at things in the longer term. In Mitch Daniels' case, he was an example of what was cited earlier. Do it at the beginning of your first term. He also had an attitude of, you know, if I don't get reelected, I'll get back my life. Ed Rendell is term limited, but I wouldn't want to suggest that was a factor. I think it does take very strong leadership of that kind.
Okay, well, thanks. We turn now to Pennsylvania. Roy Kinitz is here. He's the Deputy Chief of Staff in the Office of the Governor, Ed Rendell, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm proud to say that Governor Rendell, when he was mayor of Philadelphia, was a Ristin lecturer at the Manhattan Institute. He's been a friend of the Institute, subject of City Journal articles. Roy Kinitz previously served as Secretary of Planning for the state of Maryland. He's held positions in the federal government as well. And he's here to report on the Pennsylvania Turnpike situation. Roy.
Thank you, folks. Our situation is rather complicated, I think, as anyone who has been reading the papers on this matter can probably tell. The most recent development of which is that at the end of the day on September 30th, that was the deadline for the pendency of the bid for the turnpike by the team made up of Abertis and City and their investors, and that was a deadline which had been extended from previous deadlines, and that deadline came and went without an extension of the bid. What that means in technical terms is they gave us a $100 million letter of credit, and if we had been able to pass legislation and come to the table to close the transaction and they had refused to sign the papers, I could keep their $100 million. That's not to say now that I no longer have that hammer over them that we couldn't consummate the deal. And that's really the sort of strange middle ground we're in now, which is, you know, I've had obviously many a conversation with them several times a day over the last month. They're still interested in doing the transaction. They are just have a big question mark in their minds about what the timeline might possibly be and what the financial markets will look like whenever that day comes, if ever, when we're able to consummate the deal from our end. We're still interested in consummating the deal. You know, if and when we ever get legislation passed in Pennsylvania, my first call will be to them to say, if you're still good for the $12.8 billion, we still think that's a good number. Now, if the financial markets have sort of drastically changed their outlook between now and then, I suppose an argument could be made that more money could be gained by rebidding the process. Everything that I have read recently, including two reports I saw on email this morning, one was a rating from Credit Suisse and one was one other European financial analyst estimating that Abertis had overpaid by about $2 billion. So whether or not anyone else will be willing to come up in the future and offer a bid of that amount, I don't know. I feel pretty good about having run a process that got them to overpay by $2 billion. And I think it's a testament to the incisiveness and the quality of the team that worked with us on it, which, by the way, included John on behalf of Mayor Brown as our eminence grise on all matters P3, but also Morgan Stanley, our bankers. And this really gets me to sort of the central point of how we have approached this issue. I mean, Governor Rendell's interest in P3 has been much like the rest of his career, which is it's not really based on philosophy. We don't come in here with a philosophy to say that we are in favor of the government managing things or we are in favor of the private sector managing things. What he is in favor of achieving particular specific goals on behalf of the people who elect him. One of those is a dramatic increase in the level of investment in infrastructure in Pennsylvania and in America. And so what he did is look around for how can I possibly achieve that? The particular situation we were confronted with in Pennsylvania having to do with its odd politics made the turnpike a very obvious choice. I am not one who chooses to argue with the point of view expressed by Mr. Foote, who is here somewhere, there he is, that the public sector can probably do this just as well. Our issue always is, will it actually do it just as well? And I think that's part of what John was pointing to. Richard Daley's the mayor of Chicago. The mayor of Chicago owns Midway Airport. Midway Airport is run by the mayor of Chicago. Therefore, it's his airport and he can run it however he wants. except anyone who has ever actually spent their life working in the government knows that that's a very simple description of something that, in fact, bears absolutely no relation to that in the real world. And that's the situation in which we confronted ourselves. Turnpike Commission probably could have gone out and done a very similar level of monetization for this as to what we received in private bids. We actually went to them and asked them about that, and they said, there's absolutely no way I'm ever going to do that. What, are you insane? And so then that led us to take a different path. And the other thing that's true is that, you know, I know the people in the bidder community perhaps don't want to hear this, but I think it's a truism of this business. Our job in the public sector is to write a contract which protects our interests in exactly the way we want. Their job is to complain about it mercilessly, which they do, and which I've spent, you know, hundreds of hours on the phone with various people hearing that. And then our job is to set up a bidding process which whips them into such a frenzy that they overpay. You know, I'm never going to get that out of the members and staff of the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission who show up for work at 9:45 and leave at 3:30. I mean, that's the nature of those people, their business, the incentive system, where they've come from, what they know and what they want. That's their nature. You know, the guys in the investment banks, I get emails from starting from 6:15 in the morning and ending at 11:30 at night. And then, you know, I get the junior person who's not a partner yet emails me the document I asked for that morning at 2:30 a.m. And only then do they go home. And so the nature of who you're dealing with is just totally different. Now, if that ultimately doesn't turn into value for the voter, I'm not sure I care. But our analysis really was that, you know, in the process of putting together the legislation which eventually became Pennsylvania Act 44, which was going to fund transportation in part by monetizing turnpike revenues and in part by monetizing future potential tolling of Interstate 80 revenues, you know, I had my Morgan Stanley guys go do a very sophisticated analysis of how much we thought the public sector agency could leverage those revenue streams to generate a very large amount of money. And we went back to our legislative colleagues and said, if you're going to do this, I just want you to know, these guys are hiding money. They could give you hundreds of millions of dollars a year more for the things that you care about. According to this analysis, I had my analysts and their analysts in the room, and their analysts, you know, tried to poke every hole in the analysis done by my analysts, and, you know, there weren't holes in it. But the truth of the matter is, the answer is, they don't want to. They just don't want to do it. And so that's what really led us to be, and led the governor to be so adamant that P3 for the turnpike was the way to go. Now, I think the comments that were made earlier are true, which is the politics of these individual things, the individual politics of P3 about what project in what place at what time is enormously more important than any generic politics of the issue. You know, Richard Daley and Ed Rendell have known each other for a very long time since they were both district attorneys at the same time, many, many years ago, and they're both avid White Sox fans, as the governor was telling me yesterday. And they share a lot of character traits, as John said. There is, however, a rather large difference between the inherent powers and the political reality of the mayor of Chicago versus the governor of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania system is not really a strong governor system. In the world of, you analyze executive agencies, we have a divided legislature, and we have a whole lot of government run by agencies that have Democrat and Republican appointees, which we don't directly control, and are independent agencies, the Turnpike Commission being one. So, you know, we have to do basically everything by persuasion, and you can't strong-arm people into doing stuff. You have to make clear to them and to the people that they work for that your proposal is something they should do because you actually thought about it, and it makes sense, and there's not any other way out of the box that anyone's ever going to vote for. And so our issue really is that takes time. And so as I said to a lot of the people in our bidder community in this project very early on, we've had pretty good success getting done what the governor wants to do, in part because we don't propose things that are crazy. You know, we actually think it through pretty well beforehand. The thing that we have had very little success at is getting anything done quickly. And that, unfortunately, is a potentially a make-or-break issue in the world of P3, because those guys are get in, get everyone to work 15 hours a day, analyze the project, put in the bids, lock in my financing for 90 days, hope the market doesn't go crazy, and then, you know, yes or no. The idea that you work on a time scale that's 1, 2, 3 years of working people over, getting the ideas in, allowing the sort of to percolate, allowing the reality of the funding crisis to kind of hit people on an individual level, allow them to absorb that. You know, that's how politics tends to work, is in that very slow kind of, you know, inching along fashion. And so there may be a disconnect there that is impossible to bridge. I don't know. Governor's still very committed to the idea. The hole in our funding program is billions and billions of dollars over the next decade. That is going to require the postponement or cancellation of hundreds of road and bridge projects, hundreds of transit investment projects. A list of those projects, as you might imagine, is being assembled by the people who are in charge of making such lists, and that is going to be made available to everybody. Now, I think everyone understood in theory that if the tolling of Interstate 8 does not happen and we don't do P3, there's an expectation for spending that will now not be able to be met. They all understand it in theory. Okay, so now we're going to understand it in particular, and everyone's going to see the lists of exactly how the shortfall is going to affect them personally, the communities they care about. And then they're going to hear from people back home who actually have a particular attachment to that project and really believe it needs to be done and are now upset that it won't be done. And this is not something that we do punitively. It's reality. If we $500 million a year we're now not going to get because the tolling plan was disapproved, well, that's $500 million a year that we can't do. So here's what that means. So where that leads, I don't know. The institutional resistance to the Turnpike deal certainly is robust in Pennsylvania and maybe will never be overcome. But, you know, Ed Rendell is not someone who got where he is by giving up when someone said no. He keeps asking. So that's sort of going to be our posture. And I will be available for lots of questions from any and all.
Just real quickly, though, the opposite question from John, who saw success in Chicago, what do you see as the nature of the resistance that's been so hard to overcome to this date?
I would say it's three or four things. There is a community of people who I think are genuine believers in John's sort of, why should we have the private sector run something that's a governmental function? It just strikes them as wrong, and so their default reaction is, unless this is really, really convincing, I'm a no. That's fair. You know, from having studied it, I guess I don't have that reaction in the particular so much. The second of which is, you know, the very particular politics of this. The Pennsylvania Turnpike is a reasonably well-run road. Plow it reasonably well. The history of toll increases has been off and on, but we increased tolls when we got there, and we're doing a big set of capital projects. The road gets plowed. The lights stay on. You know, it's not a badly run roadway. It's not a very efficiently run roadway. And part of the reason for that is the job of toll taker for $17 an hour, of which there are about 2,000, is a job that is made by the board of directors of the agency. You know, the staff doesn't have authority to go hire some guy to collect tolls because there might be a cousin of a neighbor of a state legislator who might not have a job. You know, so that's the nature of the beast that you're dealing with. And it's not just the toll takers. It's the law firms. It's the bond counsel. It's the engineering companies. It's the consultants of any and all kinds. It's what bank they deposit the change in every night that they take home. Every single one of those decisions is a decision that's handled in a political way. It doesn't mean that it's done badly, but it often means that the person who gets the work has nothing to do whether that's the most qualified person or can provide the best value. Sometimes, and many times the work gets done fine. Sometimes we overpay dramatically. I mean, I had an experience in which I was doing a bond deal to build a new hockey arena in Pittsburgh. We had someone come in and quote us of, you know, what the bond council fees would be on this deal. My financial advisor said, I have to sign a piece of paper certifying that all costs are reasonable. I can't sign that. And so we went back to the person who'd offered the quote and said, where did you get this number? He's like, oh, that's what I got on the last Turnpike deal. You know, it was double, 2.5 times market. You know, so if at the end of the day they run the roadway fine and there's not some greater good that we can achieve with the capital that might be available there, I think the governor's attitude is much as John said, just because there is value doesn't mean you take it. I think he was content to let them kind of do their own business and, you know, who needs the hassle?
But once it becomes clear that we have a gargantuan hole in the transportation financing in the state, and these guys can be the ones who fix it, but it means we're going to have to change some of the old way of doing things, then that's when my boss gets, you know, a bit of a pit bull attitude.
That's when you start that list of all the projects that aren't going to be built.
Yeah, you know.
Okay, very enlightening. Well, as I said earlier in the morning, the idea of public-private partnerships is gaining fast traction right here in New York State, thanks to Governor David Paterson, who is today, maybe at this very hour, I don't know, signing an executive order creating a new state commission on the maximization of the value of public assets. And it's not too catchy, but I think it's exactly what we're talking about here today. And we are fortunate. Tim Gilchrist was going to be here representing the governor's office. We're fortunate that the governor has dispatched Samara Behrend, who is going to be the executive director of this new commission. She's going to be talking to us a bit this morning about what that commission will be doing, why the governor has felt compelled to create it, and also looking at a specific project, as our other panelists are doing, here in New York State, the prospective new Tappan Zee Bridge. Samara.
Well, it's great to be here with all of you today. I just have to commend the Manhattan Institute for their impeccable timing to host this event today, one day after the announcement of the governor's new commission. I don't know if you have ESP or you have some kinds of incredible connections far and wide. But this commission that the governor has announced, I think, has tremendous promise for the state. And it's promise in terms of the way that the governor is approaching the issue of privatization. The way that the commission will work is it's going to be comprised of 11 people who are from different stakeholders. It's going to have at least one member from organized labor. It's going to have a member from Dean Skelos, who's from our Senate, who's going to have the opportunity to appoint. Assembly is going to have one person, and the governor will have the opportunity to appoint at least four people. So it's going to be a diverse group, including all the different stakeholders. The chairperson of the commission is Charlotte Hitchcock, who is the Deputy Secretary for Labor and Finance for the governor. And she brings a unique perspective to this and the ability to bring organized labor around and to work with them in a collaborative setting. You know, this commission announcement comes on the heels of the Tappan Zee, and it comes in the midst of all of this sort of economic strife that we have. And the emphasis that the governor really wants to be put out there is that this is not an effort to close any kind of budget gaps. This is an effort to look at PPP, look at injecting new capital into New York State in a long-term process. So, you know, our intention is not to close any budget gaps in the 2009-2010 budget, but our intention is to look at how we can bring private capital in, how we can, in many cases, retain control of these state assets while at the same time utilizing the benefits of private capital. And with the Tappan Zee Bridge, the announcement was just made that we're going to be looking at a replacement bridge, that we're entering into the environmental process, but that we want a replacement bridge with a BRT option and with commuter rail. And the replacement bridge, contrary, I think a few people had said that it would be a greenfield, it's actually a brownfield project because there's an existing revenue stream. From, you know, the bridge was created in 1955, so there's a pattern there of traffic that we'll have to use to look at projections for funding. So the issues with the bridge, we need a replacement bridge because, as many of you know who travel over and who read the articles, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And honestly, the bridge is structurally deficient. It was created in the 50s at a time when, you know, during the Korean War, there was lack of materials to build this bridge, and they built it in the most efficient means possible. And it's structurally sound and safe right now, but to last this for another 50 years, the cost to maintain it would be exorbitant, and it just wouldn't make sense to protect us for all of the environmental the threats that we have out there that we need to protect against. So this group has decided that it's comprised of the Commissioner of Transportation, who's sort of leading this cause with the Thruway Authority and Metro North, that the best option is to replace the bridge. So going forward with the commission that I'm charged with being involved in, we will be looking at the Tappan Zee Bridge as one of the options for privatization. The price tag is $6 billion to replace the bridge. That's aside from the BRT option, which is another about $2.9 billion. And then if we have the commuter rail, that would be an additional $6 billion. And as you know, if we were to privatize this road, the state would have to provide some sort of subsidy for commuter rail. But what we want to look at in this commission, along with other assets aside from the Tappan Zee, is how can we bring in private sector capital? How can the state retain control? And how can we manage these assets more efficiently and perform with more greater performance? And I just want to close in saying that I'm very hopeful in terms of the success. The governor has tasked us with a lot in 90 days. We have to issue our first report and come up with some measurable actions that the commission can take. But I'm very hopeful because the way that the governor has approached this, he has not said we have to have privatization. He has not said, we have to, this is not about selling off any assets. It's about looking at this option and taking the time to assess whether or not it's right for New York State. And I think that doing it in this deliberative approach could bring some good success.
So if I might just pin you down a bit, Samara, so would you envision the new Tappan Zee as a build, operate, transfer project?
It could be. We're reserving that right. I mean, we don't have design build legislation right now, so that would have to happen in the future, in the near future.
But no fire sale of state assets, I hear you saying.
No.
Okay. Our last panel member is the Manhattan Institute's own E.J. McMahon. He's the director of the Empire State Center for New York State Policy. I think many of you know him as really one of the most trenchant observers in Albany of the passing political parade. You may not know he's former deputy tax commissioner for the state of New York. And E.J. is a guide, I think, for us for the political economy of these projects. My colleague, E.J. McMahon.
Thank you, Howard. As Howard mentioned, I am, in effect, the Manhattan Institute's man in Albany, among other things, and that leads me to take a somewhat blinded or at least a very sharply focused view of events when we talk about 3P projects from a global and national perspective. I tend to be the guy who's in the role of the mythical Boston newspaper reporting on the nuclear blast that destroyed New York City. You've heard about that. The headline was "Hub Man Killed in Gotham Blast." So I tend to focus almost too sharply sometimes on New York. The working title of our panel has to do with case studies. I feel safe in saying that New York City and State are probably the nation's best, most explicit case study in how not to address infrastructure needs. And therefore, the public-private partnership option is particularly interesting and provocative here. I would mention, though, to be fair, that New York was a PPP pioneer in its own right back in the early 90s. Unfortunately, the kind of PPP the state did was public-public partnerships, in which case that was the days when Governor Cuomo sold state highways to the Thruway Authority, sold state prisons to the UDC, and famously, as Steve Savas mentioned, sold the racetrack parking lot to the Port Authority. The Port Authority being an institution that crops up frequently in this public-public partnership conversation. As Professor Gomez-Ibanez stated, and citing the usual reasons given for the interest in privatization of infrastructure projects, there's a general perception that the public sector lacks resources, and in that it lacks resources largely because taxpayers won't support the needed taxes to finance those resources. Now, that's not actually true in New York. Regardless of the extent to which taxpayers actually support this regime, there is no shortage of tax revenue in New York. New York State, as you may have noticed, is a high-tax place. It taxes everything that moves and many things that don't move. And among the areas in which we have high taxes, for reasons dating back in particular to that 3P era I mentioned earlier, the early 90s, is our very high fuel tax. We have the highest fuel taxes in the country, usually rivaling 1, 2, or 3 Connecticut and California, certainly the highest gas taxes in the Northeast other than Connecticut. And the reason we have a gas tax of 42 or 43 cents per gallon, it may be up to 44 cents now, is because we have one of the nation's largest, if not the largest, dedicated capital transportation infrastructure funds supported by that tax. So why do we have problems? Why do we have such gross deficiencies, which we do, in both our mass transit and highway and bridge capital programs? Because the political economy of New York is such that all the money, that money has been leveraged up, it's been spoken for, and it's that fund is basically tapped out. And so what we've gotten in exchange for our high gas taxes is insufficient resources for capital transportation infrastructure needs. That's what leads to public skepticism when further talk comes up about raising taxes for infrastructure. So it's really refreshing that Governor Patterson is talking about 3P in a whole different context, that he wants to have New York join the national trend, if it is a trend, and I, as was noted earlier, maybe it's not so much a trend as an intermittent impulse, to explore public-private partnerships as a solution to the state's needs. And again, this is a case, though, however, of need rather than want. The state is exploring this option not because it really wants to get the private sector involved in finding more innovative, creative, and efficient solutions to transportation infrastructure, because it's badly in need of money and does not have the money to meet those needs now. So how do we look at this, and how do we and what is the possible meaning of Governor Patterson's plan? Well, I think that it's, again, very promising that he's brought some very talented people in to run the exploration that's going to take place through his commission, and that he's stated the priority, to quote from his the press release describing his executive order, of attempting to maximize the value, efficiency, and safety of assets like our infrastructure. And that really is a core focus here. However, there's also a danger that the commission is going to be attempting to reconcile the irreconcilable, because as was noted, another priority of the commission is the protection of public employees and of prevailing wage and labor standards. Now, these are not necessarily consistent with the maximization of value, efficiency, and safety of assets. As was mentioned earlier, we have a Wix law in New York State, which drives up the cost of public construction. We have project labor agreements in place under the encouragement of state law. We have prevailing wage standards that are very stringent and are very stringently enforced. And all of these items drive up the cost of public sector capital construction, which is a reason why I would disagree with one thing John Foote said earlier, or not disagree, but want to amplify something he said, which was he noted that private capital, I think he said that private capital comes with baggage. Public capital comes with baggage also, and that baggage is the need to protect public employees and prevailing wage and labor standards, among other things, because public sector capital construction has been very democratized. And there are many people with an interest in this, and the political economy of public sector infrastructure and infrastructure construction is that there are a great many rent seekers circulating around in and around the process, and they want their needs taken care of. And that's why there's always a danger here. I think that it's easy for us to conceive of a situation in which a project like the Tappan Zee Bridge ideally is put up for bid as a sort of a single project in which, on a turnkey basis, in which private builder operators are invited to come up with the most innovative, creative approach to building a bridge and running a bridge in a way that will be consistent with the public interest, producing a stream of revenues that can make it worthwhile for them over a very long period of time. Under the construct that Bill Lunnart mentioned earlier, where one regionalized a throughway, for instance, and thought of doing something like that, it's possible to envision that taking place. There would be high transactional costs, to be sure. The complexity of the financial arrangements, and not to mention the operating agreement for that type of project, would be very great and would be greater than anything we've seen before in New York State. But it is possible to envision that. It's also easily possible to imagine that, given the political nature of Albany, is that we won't get anything close to that kind of project for the Tappan Zee Bridge. And that the political imperative, the default imperative from Albany, is to maximize some sort of upfront payment from some private sector firm or firms involved in the construction of the bridge, while also maximizing public control of the project, including no change in existing laws affecting the use of labor, public and private, on the bridge, both in the construction of the new bridge and in its operation in the future. So there is an interesting tension here. I think that's, again, some of the criticisms and questions that have been raised about private sector involvement in public construction are legitimate and provocative, and should give us pause. I think that many of the standards that have been used to compare private and public scenarios, especially on greenfields projects, are not taking full account of the baggage that goes with the public sector financing advantage, and that cost-benefit analysis needs to take fuller account of those things in comparing the costs. Finally, I would suggest that there's one phrase that should give us all pause. It's used sometimes in different ways and with different meanings by different people. But at a time when you're looking at probably the most severe fiscal crisis the state has faced since the 1970s, when the term monetization is used to describe what is desired out of a particular public-private partnership, I think it's time to check your wallet and your watch. Monetization, that is the focus on money, may betray a focus on upfront payments, on a desire, in effect, to securitize, to use another term, a revenue stream, which is not too far from simply being another way of simply mortgaging something that you've mortgaged once or twice already, and of avoiding issuing public sector debt through some device that has a private sector label. So all of these are some of the risks associated with the status quo. There's definitely a lot of risks. There's also risks, again, with the private sector partnership approach, if that approach is merely used as a way to squeeze money out of assets rather than as a way to truly pursue innovation and efficiency and the public interest. And so thank you, and I look forward to taking part in the questions.
John and Roy, very quickly. Speakers this morning, earlier in the day, were critical of the idea of cross-subsidies coming out of the revenue stream from public-private partnerships, saying that those monies, in order to retain public support long-term, had to be demonstrating efficiencies and improvement in service in the actual facility that was the subject of the public-private partnership. Both of you seem to be taking exactly the opposite point of view, that a key selling point is raising revenue for a whole array of other uses in the city and state. I wonder if each of you would comment on that tension, if you will.
Well, I believe there should be an improvement in services. One of the mantras in Chicago is we should never privatize anything unless we think we will get a higher quality of services independent of any financial considerations. So I think there should be an improvement in the quality of the services. But whether the proceeds should be used for the same area in which you recovered them, I don't know of any inherent reason why that should be true. The Skyway revenues were already going into general revenues of the city of Chicago. So it's not as though there was some sudden diversion. There were just more revenues available. You know, the idea that, that the proceeds from the privatization of Midway Airport should what? Stay in the air aviation industry? That doesn't make any sense at all. We've only got, well, we got two airports, but we're not about to take the Midway proceeds and use them at O'Hare. So I do think there's obviously a lot in the notion that you should generally use proceeds from in effect a sale or disposition of a capital asset for capital purposes. But the notion that those have to be capital purposes that are within the same specific area where you realize those proceeds, I don't see any inherent reason why that should be true, and I don't think it is true as a general political matter in this country that we operate that way.
Roy, on that point?
I generally agree. I would say that if you're trying to make the case to change the management of an asset, if you can't point to how that management will someday be improved, it's hard to make the case. So I think as a political matter, that's true. As a matter of policy, I mean, the purpose of government is cross-subsidy. That's what it is. We collect revenues generally, and we set priorities in order to take care of things, most of which can't pay for, you know, we don't ask the army to pay for itself, you know? That's the nature of government. And so the idea that government would generally have sources of revenue, set priorities in relation to what actually needs to happen rather than what's going to generate money, if there's no cross-subsidization, the private sector could run everything. So I guess I don't accept the premise. I think as a practical matter, if you're going to suck the blood out of a particular asset and run it and do nothing for it, no one's ever going to support you. So you need to stick to your knitting at some level. But
okay,
we don't use the proceeds of gambling taxes to support the gambling industry, for example.
You're sure about that? Okay. Wait for the microphone, but right, Bill. Yeah, hang on.
Thank you. For John Schmidt, the winning bids and the second low bids in both Chicago and Indiana were $1 billion apart. In other words, the winning bidder left $1 billion on the table. Can you explain how that works? What the economics of the finance? How'd that happen?
If you ask the Macquarie people, they will tell you that their bidding philosophy is to decide what an asset is worth. What is the maximum amount they are prepared to pay for it and go in and bid that? And if the result of that is that they end up paying more than the second bids by a lot, they think that is a price you pay as opposed to trying to play games and win, you know, by the narrowest amount and therefore lose out on assets that you really want. So they always said in the Skyway, and I have to say they acted on the basis that the fact that they were $1 billion ahead of the next bidder didn't bother them. In Indiana, they were, as you say, a little more, well, about $1 billion ahead there. But, you know, it's also the nature of an auction process, particularly when what you're doing is effectively selling equity, that you often get very different assessments. I mean, I spent most of my professional life doing corporate M&A work, and I can tell you, if you're selling a subsidiary of a company, it's not uncommon at all, particularly in the initial stage of indicative bids, to have a low bid that is, you know, 50% below and a high bid that's double. You tend in those processes to narrow them down more before you get to the end, and in public processes, there's been a reluctance to do that, because it requires some discretionary judgments about who you think are the real bidders. So you may have a greater spread by the time you get to the final bidding stage than you have in the private sector. But it's really not that uncommon to have one bidder who thinks a company is worth X and another bidder who thinks it's worth, you know, double X.
Hang on, Bill.
What accounted for the differences? I think the principal difference in the Skyway was two things. One, an estimate of toll sensitivity. How much would traffic decline as a result of particular toll increases? In fact, the city had traffic projections done by a forecasting agency that showed a very significant fall off from toll increases. The Cintra Macquarie forecast done by another firm showed no fall off. They turned out to be right. When the tolls went from $2 to $2.50, when they took over, traffic actually increased. But the other actually larger difference, I believe, is in the traffic level projections. Cintra Macquarie did their own model of the Chicago regional traffic flow, and they concluded, in part, interestingly, because they didn't think there would be the kind of improvements elsewhere that some other people were anticipating, and therefore traffic on the Skyway would, in fact, increase more, and there was unused capacity on the Skyway over time. So it was actually, I think, more the traffic, but it was also toll sensitivity.
Interesting. Yeah, yes, the woman in green right here in the middle. Wait for the microphone. There it is.
Joyce Miller, Tier 1 Public Strategies. But my understanding of what happened in the Chicago Skyway deal was that there was also some controversy over the way in which Macquarie valued and the firm that they used to value the Skyway deal and the traffic projections, that there was a relationship between the firm that was doing the valuation and Macquarie, that the firm that was doing the valuation was being paid on a successful bid basis, which is what Macquarie habitually does. And there were some questions about, in the long term, how realistic the projections were, whether Macquarie itself wasn't boosting their bid in this instance because it was the first major deal of this kind to be done, and that they had an interest, therefore, in winning the bid, winning the publicity, and establishing themselves as the leader in the field.
I'm not sure it's a question, John, but you're welcome to answer.
Well, it's good to go first, you know, and I think that was an advantage for Chicago on the Skyway. I think it's an advantage right now on Midway Airport. But, of course, those issues you're raising are really their problem. In reality, I think in all these deals, there tend to be at least three sets of projections. There's one done by the public entity. There's one done by the bidder. There's another one done by the lenders. And I once heard a lender ask the question, how do you do your projections? He said, well, we start by taking whatever the bidders gave us, and we discount by 25%. So, this projecting future traffic flow and future toll revenues is not a science, as Roy has come to learn also. It comes down to judgment calls about, you know, what you think is going to happen to the economy of Pennsylvania and what you think, you know, how you think drivers are going to react to toll increases. So I had never heard that specifically, that they were criticized for paying their traffic forecaster on a success fee basis. But, you know, people pay their investment bankers that way, and they seem to think it doesn't impair their independence.
And my comment would be, if they overpaid, that's good for me. I want them to do that. I want them to act irrationally and pay more than it's worth, because I'm trying to get the best deal for the taxpayer. Now, there I hope, presumably, if I were to work for them, I'd be desperately trying not to do that. And so that's the nature of the tension. But at the end of the day, if they made a mistake, we have their money. So the mistake is made, and it's on them, and the taxpayer is the beneficiary.
Two or three more quickies. Was there a question in the back there? Julia Vitula Martin of our Center for Rethinking Development. Wait for the microphone, Julia.
My question is also for John Schmidt. I think there's a disturbing analogy between what's happening in Chicago and EJ's talk. In EJ's talk, he said public capital comes with baggage, protecting public employees. And in Mr. Schmidt's talk on Chicago, he said there aren't going to be operating cost reductions on the labor side, you know, presumably because of Chicago politics. And, you know, of course, there is a predecessor example of the privatization of airports, and that's London, where there also weren't any operating costs reductions on the labor side. So I'm sort of wondering why you're so optimistic.
Well, I wouldn't really agree that the only reason there aren't going to be operating cost reductions or why there are labor protections is because of Chicago politics. I think there's a policy judgment being made there to protect the employees at the airport. The policy judgment on the Skyway and on the airport is to carry over all of the existing public policies that apply. So MBWB contracting, for example, and residency preferences in hiring, and prevailing wage standards on construction projects. Even the CapEx cost savings that are achieved in Chicago are not achieved by escaping any of those public policies. And in the case of the employees at the airport, it was a policy judgment, and actually it was a legislative decision in order to do the transaction, although Chicago has home rule authority, which is an important factor, and therefore can do things like this without having to go to, in our case, Springfield, the way New York has to go to Albany, in order to deal with a real estate tax issue that would otherwise exist and would impose real estate taxes on the lessee. We did have to pass a state statute And as part of that bargaining process, we negotiated with the Chicago Federation of Labor for the labor protections that were put into the agreement. So I don't think that's going to have an adverse effect on the operations of the airport. I think it is going to reduce somewhat the potential return to the private operator and probably reduce somewhat the bid that we would have gotten, just as was true in Pennsylvania.
But you'd stick to your view that the service level would improve, notwithstanding the cost structure remaining the same?
Yes, I think that's correct.
I'm going to go to more questions rather than further comments. JP, microphone. We'll make JP's the last question.
This question is for EJ. I was intrigued by your comment about rent sinking.
A cynical question about campaign finance, if you didn't hear it, and who might be contributing to whom to get what favors.
I think that what happens, it would seem to me that in a case like this, no detailed study, but it would seem to me in a case like this, you're simply expanding or changing the cast of characters who are seeking to influence the political system. We already have a system that is, nothing is built by the government. It's all built by private contractors. Those private contractors, in fact, are a significant force politically and a significant force in shaping policy. My skepticism comes from, I may be missing something, and I'm trying to learn more about this, and it's a subject we can't simply give the answer to right now. But when I hear that, particularly with a brownfield project, as opposed to something that's at least semi-green like the Tappan Zee Bridge, which is new but old, it's in its, you know, it's got its own liabilities, but it's there. But a pure brownfield project, I still can't quite understand from a public finance standpoint, if you are leaving intact all of the programs and policies that currently shape the expense of building and operating a public asset, if somebody comes up to me and says, okay, leave intact all of the programs and policies that now shape what it costs to build and run this asset, and I'll give you $2 billion up front, or fill in the blank. I am immediately skeptical of that. I want to know what the details are. Because here's why. Not that it's not worth, the revenue stream is not worth that amount, but I want to know what the difference is between that and simply issuing a bond, as was done by New York State, really under similar circumstances in the early 90s, and saying, well, the tolls, the thruway is now paid for, let's refinance it and buy our worthless canal system in the process, which is what was done then. That was monetizing the Thruway Authority in a different way. That's the hurdle I can't jump over in hearing about some of these projects. It's not hostility to the potential that value that could be unlocked by the private sector. It's just questioning the way some of these deals seem to be structured.
Okay, I'm going to thank our panelists. I think we heard from both panels this morning that combination of strong political leadership and demonstrated efficiencies and improvements to the public are what's going to make these kind of deals fly, if they are going to fly. I'd like to offer to Samara a transcript of this, since this was somehow turned out to be the first public hearing for your commission, kind of, and we'll get you a transcript. But let's thank this panel and.